This episode is brought to you by Cabot Creamery, celebrating 100 years of being a dairy farm family-owned cooperative. Learn more at cabotcheese.coop. That's cabotcheese.coop.
This week on Meat and Three, we celebrate good news in the food world, from record-setting butter sculptures to the latest discoveries in crop cultivation.
I think it was back in 2015. It was 2,370 pounds, and it was a Paris landscape. And so that became the Guinness World Record butter sculpture.
We don't understand everything about the world. So plant breeding also lets us work with all the unknown, maybe discovered along the way.
And we hear from the beloved chef and disaster relief organizer, Jose Andres.
Well, World Central Kitchenware organization that we like to be the first ones on the ground. And more often than not, we are the last ones on the ground.
Tune in to Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right. Good afternoon, curd nerds. Welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I am Aaron Foster, your host for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Some of you may not know this about me. I own Foster Sundry. It's a cheese shop, but it's also a butcher shop. And this week over at the shop, we're doing something a little bit different, and we are bringing in a retired dairy cow to sell as our beef this week. And it got me thinking sort of about sustainability and about how that works and about the beef we normally carry and the beef that people normally eat. And I thought it would be a really good conversation to have with a farmer who can tell us a little bit more about this. And it's actually the farmer who milked the animal for pretty much her whole life and then sent her down our way. So please let me introduce Dan Brooks of Wayward Goose Farm. Dan is a fifth generation dairy farmer, I believe, and since 2011 has owned Wayward Goose with his spouse, Laurie. Laurie works on the farm. Their son, Peter, works nearby and owns a brewery, is making beer. And then their daughter, Margot, is also in the biz and is making cheese over at Sugar House Creamery. And we're huge fans of their cheese as well. So I'd like to welcome Dan. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you?
Thanks again for joining us. We're reaching you where? In West Paulet in Vermont?
Correct.
Great. And I appreciate you being flexible on having the talk a little bit before milking. I know I tried to get you at exactly the wrong moment earlier.
Yeah, this works much better. Thanks.
Good. So why don't you tell us just a little bit about Wayward Goose, about your history, and how you kind of came to end up doing what you're doing, because I think it's obviously farming is a huge part of the American cultural landscape, but you know, I'm sitting here in Brooklyn in a shipping container watching people eat fancy pizza.
So
why don't you paint us a picture?
So the farm that I grew up on and worked on and raised my family at, my daughter Margot went away to school, decided she wanted to do something sustainable in farming and kind of wanted to come back to our farm and do something there. But the rest of my family wasn't interested in that. So it's a long story, but we ended up here in West Paulet on a much smaller operation and making cheese milk for Consider Bardwell that's right next door to us.
So the farm you were originally on, was it nearby West Paulet or somewhere else?
No, it was about 3 hours southwest near Cooperstown, New York.
Gotcha. And it was just the family kind of split apart and decided to do something different?
Yeah, there was kind of a crossroads. It didn't look like there was any room for any of my kids to come back and work with us on the farm. And Margot had gotten a job working to learn how to make cheese at Consider Bardwell next door to here.
Yes, and I should say we love Margot's cheeses. We're huge fans. And On a very early, before we opened Sundry, we kind of took a sourcing trip to meet some of our early farmers, both meat suppliers and cheese suppliers, and got a chance to go up there and stay with her, and it was great.
Yeah, great.
So you guys started, and so the put us in time here. We're early 2010, 2011, somewhere in there.
Yeah, January of 2011, we moved here and we bought a farm that hadn't been a dairy farm in a few decades, I would guess. We haven't found out for sure, but so it had an old dairy barn on it, needed a lot of work, and we spent the winter remodeling the barn, and we're about ready for cows in the spring, and so we started out with three brown Swiss cows. We got a good deal on three, yearling heifers when we were midway through our first winter, and we bought those. And then when we were ready to get more milking cows in the spring, a herd of Jersey cows came up for sale that looked good. So we bought some of those. And
so was the idea, most, I mean, three cows sounds like a small number of cows. What was the original plan? Was it always tied to providing milk for local dairies, for cheesemakers, or was the idea to kind of sell into the milk chain and go that route?
No, the idea was always to make milk for Consider Bardwell. They were right next door and needed another milk, cow milk supply, and So
was Margot really the connection there? Like you didn't know about them or weren't planning on kind of working with them? Because I imagine it must be a really important partnership.
Yeah, Margot was the connection. She went there to learn how to make cheese with the thought of coming back to our farm. But that when that didn't work out, we sold our share of that and moved here. So
that's a really nice kind of kismet there.
Yep.
And so why brown Swiss? I imagine that wasn't what you were milking before.
No, we milked Holsteins. We did rotational grazing and milked about 92 cows. Our barn held 92 cows and had some crosses, some Swiss crosses. And I had always liked the Swiss, but we weren't sure what we were going to milk here. We knew it needed to be a high component breed.
Right, so you're not just looking for volume, you're looking for fat and protein and all the important components for cheese making.
Yeah, and Consider Bardwell has some pretty strict parameters for their milk. We can't feed any fermented feed, so it's all dry hay and grass and a little bit of grain.
Right, so why don't we take we should step aside for one moment and say that we love Consider Bardwell, we love their cheeses. They're going through a bit of a tough spot right now with a recall, and I could speak to that, or you could.
I can say what I know. That they did a voluntary recall, to preemptively make sure that no affected cheese got on the market. And they've tested everything at the facility and hadn't had any positive results. All the results were negative. So the FDA has just got to give them the okay to start making cheese again, I believe. And the last word we got was that they would be starting up again in early November.
Right. Obviously it's a nightmare scenario for any cheesemaker, but it also sounds like it more or less went according to plan, and that they had, their preparations in place to deal with something like this should it ever occur.
Yep. I think things are going very well. Obviously nobody wants to go through a recall, while this is all happening, we're very appreciative that one of their thoughts among the many that they have is, finding a place for our milk. So our milk is going to Grafton, and it's being made into a cloth-bound cheddar in the interim. So
that's great. Is it being separated, made to a specific cheddar? Or is it being blended with their other milk sources? Do you know?
I think from what I know, they are blending our milk with the other producer that produces for Consider Bardwell, hauling it all. So it's our two milk combined, but they're making one specific. Correct. They're making one specific cheese out of just that milk.
Well, I will reach out to them and make sure that we get some of that cheese into the shop at the very least. great. It must be hard for you or just challenging being so intertwined with another business in that way.
Yeah, it is. We really love being so connected to a product and seeing exactly where our milk goes, but it is, you know, all our eggs are in one basket, so to speak, right. And so we're tied to that too, but we're very happy to know the product that our milk's being made into instead of just being loaded on a truck and mixed with every other farm's milk and knowing what happens to it.
I have to imagine that model just wouldn't, you don't sound like you're set up for that model to work in any eventuality.
No, exactly. No, we could never make it in the commodity milk market at our size. So it's pretty specific what we're doing here. And we've explored doing our own processing, but it's a daunting thing. So we're very happy that Consider Bardwell is going to be starting up again.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think it's kind of an ideal solution. I mean, it's a solution that, as a cheesemonger, as an early cheesemonger, I've thought a lot about farmstead cheeses. And when we talk about farmstead cheeses, we think about cheeses that are made from the milk from the same farm as the dairy. But it's also a model that, puts all of the onus on the one particular producer to do everything, to care for the animals,
right,
milk the animals, make the cheese, age the cheese, sell and mark the cheese, ship the cheese.
Correct. Yeah.
And in Europe, it's quite different.
Yeah.
So how many animals do you have now?
So we have 28 mature cows. Most of them are Jerseys. We have one brown Swiss heifer out of Alice, actually, that's going to be calving in a month or so. But the rest are all Jerseys now. So,
gotcha. And we'll introduce you to Alice just before the break. So the milk, you're milking twice a day. That milk goes over, well, right now it's going to Grafton, but would normally be going to CBF, Consider Bardwell. Like, what's a typical day look like for you?
Oh, well, in the summertime, I get up, get the cows in, and if I need to wash the bulk tank, I do that to begin with, and the cows munch on a little hay if they want it in the barn while they're waiting, and then we've got a little four-cow step-through milking parlor with a viewing window so people can come and visit and open the window. Talk to me while I'm milking without getting in too close, and that works out well.
Or talk to the cows, right? I mean, who wants to talk to you?
Sure.
Right? I mean, you're busy.
Yeah. Yep, and we have a little farm store so people can come here and buy milk and eggs and maple syrup and honey and different things.
And
so then the cleanup after milking, and then I go set up a pasture, which is pretty quick. I have a movable poly wire with flexible fiberglass posts, and very quick to move the cows to a new paddock and get them back outside for the day, and then start again milking that night.
Yeah, we touched on this really briefly, but what I guess now is a good time to talk about rotational grazing and what that means for you and kind of why you choose
sure.
to do it. Do you want to give us – I could do it, or do you want to – maybe I'd love to hear just a short overview of what rotational grazing looks like for you guys. And obviously it's going to be different seasonally, but
– sure. So basically, rotational grazing is that you put the cows in a small area of good grass and let them eat it very quickly in one 12-hour session, and then move them. So the way we do it is move them out every 12 hours. So every time after they get milked, they go into a fresh patch of grass, basically. And
wow. I have to imagine you don't get away very much.
No, we don't get away very much. That's one of the drawbacks. We can't really afford a full-time hired person, and it's really hard to find somebody that can milk just a milking or two on a weekend. But
right. Milking babysitter. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're moving them every 12 hours, and over how, like what size land, how much land are we talking?
Well, we only have 20 acres of, good pasture land with our farm. So we move them through that. And in the spring, 20 acres is enough for a while, but then the grass growth slows in the hotter part of the summer. And so we just have to feed them in some round bale feeders on the hill where they have shade and water, and wait until the grass is sufficient to get them back through the rotation again.
And then in winter, they're hanging out in the barn mainly?
Yeah, and in the winter, they're always able to go in and out of the barn, so it's kind of loose housing with some stalls, and then we have another shed that the sun shines in, and it's got rubber mats on the floor with shavings on top of that, and they really, really like to be in there. We just got funding to build a composting barn for our manure storage and a covered hay feeding area, so we're excited to try those out this winter.
Awesome. That's as you kind of move forward, you're building on aspects of the process that make it easier, make it a little bit more sustainable. Is that more or less right?
Yeah, that's right. And so the manure storage barn, we also want to put solar power on the roof, and that should generate all we need for our farm and our house, and still have a little bit extra that we can send to our son at his brewery, and he can use whatever we don't need.
That's pretty wild. That's really cool, actually. Yeah. I hope that's the future. But it's interesting because it does sound like you have to make certain lifestyle sacrifices to make some of these kinds of things happen.
Yeah, it's true. It's hard to get away, even though most of our kids are a couple hours away. It's still hard to see them when we have to be back for milking at night, or
right.
You know, if we don't have a whole day, it's tough to make it there.
I imagine, and also Margo probably has the same problem.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem for anybody that's running a small farm like this, I think. And
I will say one of the sort of most moving experiences I had, or funniest, with just a conversation about rotational grazing was with Margo. When we were there, we just kind of walked by. We were touring the pasture and just stepped right over a big old cow paddy. And she kind of stops us and like puts her boot in it and kind of spreads it around and goes, "Man, this is just a perfect pile of shit here." Yep. She says, "Next year, you know, this is going to be just a big thicket of flowers and all sorts of other good stuff. And the cows are going to come back and eat this and make all the better cheese for it." So I look at this pile of shit and it is just, to me, that's future delicious cheese. And it totally stuck with me. So I took a photo of it and put it on a postcard. And now we have people sending piles, you know, pictures of cow shit all around. It's I would say, we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the other side of this, which is introducing our listeners to Alice and talking about kind of some other ways to generate revenue for a small dairy farm to keep things sustainable. And I think respectfulness is also part of this conversation. So we're going to tune out for a second and we'll chat with you again shortly.
Thanks.
Cat- Cabot Creamery is proud to be celebrating 100 years making the world's finest dairy products. Cabot's award-winning cheddars and other dairy products stand apart because of their farmers' tireless dedication to quality and freshness, to healthy land and a sustainable future. A century after they started this journey, Cabot's farmer owners still know what matters most: family and community. The simple truth that we're stronger together than we are apart. That delicious products are the reward of a job well done. That when you love what you do this much, the best is always still to come.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. Hi, my name is Sam Benrubi, and I'm the host of The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. With this show, we bring wine to the people. Each week, we bring the best guests in wine on, taste different wines on air, and invite our listeners to taste with us. You'll find our approach to wine decidedly unsnobby. You can find The Grape Nation wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we are back again. This is Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Aaron Foster, your host, and I'm here with Dan Brooks of Wayward Goose Farm. When we left off, we were talking about rotational grazing. We were talking about the exigencies of small dairy life. But now I'd like to talk about Alice. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Alice?
So Alice is one of the original brown Swiss that we bought the first year we were here. She's been a great cow. She's a brown Swiss. So we sent her to Eagle Bridge, direct to the slaughterhouse, and
well, here, let's back up for a second. Let's
sure.
Let's jump right into the. And it's funny because
right, jump too far.
Most people. This is an interesting conversation we have at the shop.
Yeah.
And so, as I said, Foster Sundry, we're a butcher shop, cheese shop, cafe, and we work with small New England farms for our beef. We don't generally do much with retired dairy cattle, although we have once or twice in the past. We people, I think these days are very interested in sustainability. I mean, and I don't want to keep sure. using this word without defining it, but I'll just leave it there for a second. Sustainability. They're interested in knowing in eating locally and knowing quote where their food comes from. And I think that's a super interesting, and I sort of ethically or morally upright trend. But it's
right.
I often find that interest stops at knowing the name of your food, this is something that I feel strongly about. When I first had an ethical crisis, let's say, about eating meat in my early 20s, and I learned to raise and kill pigs and slaughter them and turn them into food and. That was like a very sort of moving and important moment because I had seen the pigs come up and go from piglets and to full size pigs and then, and then turn them into food. And that moment when an animal goes from an animal being food is a very sort of intense personal moment. And, I think, I don't want to make this decision for other people, but I often kind of talk about how if you're not willing to slaughter the animal that you are eating, then maybe you're not really engaging with your food in the way that you think you are.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a big disconnect, and that's overall in farming. I think there's so many big farms now and a lot less small, family size farms. And so I think, there's a huge disconnect between people in the farms and the food and the animals and,
well, it's funny, this trend towards convenience, right? Like, we're very interested in convenience, particularly as a New Yorker. It's something that we value and speed and convenience and detachment. But at the same time, we really do, as a good Brooklyner, I think, trumpet this idea that we want to eat local and eat sustainable. I don't want to say we took a chance, but we... When you guys reached out to us about Alice and said that you had a retired dairy cow, that you wanted to find a home for. Like, that was something that was very appealing to me personally, just because I felt like it allows us to have those conversations. And, you know, as it's not always in the best interest as a business owner for me to force people's kind of feet to the flame. But I think it's an important conversation to have. And I think it's also important for cheese people, even if you don't eat meat, to understand what happens to these animals when they're done milking. Because I think even if you're a vegetarian and you are a big cheese fan, I think probably we don't give a lot of thought to that.
Yeah, it's true. and the same with the veal. We raise some of our calves for veal, and, you know, people are just so put off by the word veal until they hear the alternatives and right. hear why we're raising some of them for veal. And so in the so for a cow like Alice, we it's unusual for a cow to last 10 years, first of all, a dairy cow, but we're finding that a lot of our cows last 8 to 10. Our oldest cow is 13 right now, which is pretty unheard of. And
wow. And she's still milking.
And she's still milking, yep, and she's still doing well. And so the only reason we needed to get rid of Alice is that last winter she had a little bit of difficulty on the concrete in the winter, and we made the decision not to breed her back. And so she milked all summer, and then we had a date for her to go to slaughter in the fall. But we really don't like to send our cows just to an auction. First of all, they have to go through the stress of going through an auction and then get loaded on a truck and trailer and probably end up at a huge packing plant in Pennsylvania. And so we just feel so connected to our cows. We'd rather, we try to send them direct to the slaughterhouse and then sell the meat out of our own farm store, which works well. But we didn't really have room for another one at this time. So that's how we happened to get in contact with you.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, it's interesting, A, that if when you think about a lot of factory farming operations, that the cows are milked so aggressively that they really only milk for 3 or 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, these animals are milking out, you know, past 10 years or so is pretty significant. And if you're interested in consuming cheese, this is a cheese show after all, made from milk that comes from small dairy farms, traceable small dairy farms in New England or locally, this is going to be a natural sort of end stage for these animals. And I think, you know, I mentioned the word respect earlier. I think the animal's nearing the end of its lifespan. The best way to respect and honor it is to slaughter humanely and treat it carefully and not waste it and not have it go into anonymous burger patties from Costco. Or sorry, I shouldn't say that. Anonymous burger patties or pet food.
We would much rather that it's, and we've eaten these, you know, these older dairy animals ourselves, and it's really, really good. You just have to know that it's different. It's different. You know, it's a different kind of meat, and it's got a lot more flavor. The burger is amazing.
We got the animal this morning and began to break it down, and, it's just visually quite different. And, we reach out, we'll have some signage and things for our customers this week. That's just kind of, just ask us about this if you're interested. Like, our beef is from, from you guys and as a retired dairy cow, and sort of ask us what that means if you're interested. And we recognize that people have boundaries and again, don't want to push people, but it's, I particularly think of cheese people and think of cheese vegetarians and wonder, what that, because the alternative really sucks, is to like the idea of just, you know, sending the animal to auction or to whatever. And I think it's also, it's important to talk about, the fact that with a small farm like yours, the revenue streams are few. And I'm not speaking for your personal finances, obviously, but it's another way to sort of generate revenue, and it's a respectful way.
Yep, definitely. And it just makes us feel really good that that you guys see the importance of this kind of dairy beef. And we just read an article in the New Yorker about the Beyond Beef or whatever it is,
right?
And it didn't mention that there was like anything in between feedlot beef and no beef at all. And we think this is a more sustainable type of beef because this cow lasted this long. First of all, we didn't have to raise three heifers to replace her as we would in a more conventional dairy setting. And she's, picking her own grass, harvesting her own feed, spreading her own manure all through that 10 years and growing all of that grass that helps soak up the carbon. So that's
right.
I'm not a scientist, and I don't know what the actual numbers are for all of that. But to me, it's much better than feedlot beef. That's
sure. They're not being pumped full of grain and generating more methane. You're not running huge combines around to spread manure. So it's certainly, again, right, I'm not a scientist either, but there's something intuitively understandable about that that gives you, that just makes you feel, I think ought to make you feel, if you've chosen to eat meat, a little bit better and more edified about it.
Right. Our daughter did a semester in Morocco, and she brought back a tagine from Morocco. And I noticed on your website you have a Moroccan meal. That type of beef cooked like that in a tagine with some Moroccan spices is just amazing.
We'll make sure to recommend that to our customers this week. And we should talk about veal for a second too, because again, as you said, veal. For diners, I think, since the mid-90s, early 2000s, diners, at least in coastal elite diners, let's say, has been sort of a dirty word. And, I think it's sort of been partly rebranded as rose veal. Veals, I mean, you can tell us this as well, but veal are just the boy cows.
Yeah, and we're always surprised. It happens quite often. We have an Airbnb apartment, and people will come to visit the farm store and chat with me when I'm milking, and it's always amazing to me how many people don't realize that a cow has to give birth every year to keep giving milk.
But, right.
I think when people understand that there are these calves that need something, some use, but I think it's hard to get people to think beyond their already perception of veal, and see that there's another way, and it's not doesn't need to be raised the way they think it is, and so
yeah, that's when I grew up, it was just historically this very white, almost pork, white,
right,
very light looking meat, and I think it was even sold as like milk-fed veal, massaged, yeah, or something. I mean, it was the less movement, the better. And when you think about that, like, it's a horrible idea. And what we're talking about here is just not allowing these animals to grow up and become bulls, because there's only so many bulls you can use, and you're not probably using any, right? Because you're inseminating, or...
Yeah, we do all of our own artificial insemination, except we have one bull that we raised with our heifers that are out on pasture. It's just much easier than trying to catch them. But
right,
generally no. Yeah, generally there's no bulls here.
No bull at Wayward Goose Farm. That's
yeah.
So it's, yeah, that's those animals in order to, again, for them not to become pet food or to be confined for, I mean, there still but must be a tremendous market for veal in the U.S., even though I think general customer taste has changed and those animals are confined in really just not really unpleasant situations and scenarios. And the idea that you can eat veal and that it actually creates a revenue stream for a small farm is sustainable and is a more humane solution than the alternative.
Yeah, correct. And it's just a matter of getting people to, getting people to try it and, you know, to think about it enough in those terms to want to try it. So.
Well, and I think people have to understand if there's no veal, there's probably no cheese, right?
Yeah, it's true. There's got to be some sort of an outlet, and a lot of the breeds, like the Jerseys, the bull calves, are just not. Even if you can't even sell them at the auction now for veal growers because they won't take them.
Wow.
Because they're such a small, slow-growing breed, so we breed a lot of the cows to Angus so that they grow that the veal will grow faster, and then we don't have as many. Pure Jersey bulls,
and that just otherwise you're almost expending capital to get rid of them.
Yeah, there's not much alternative. If you raise them for a bull, there you could raise it for a whole year and not get as much as you can for a veal. But you know, it takes up a lot of resources to raise all the calves too.
Right. I mean, and that's another thing about the dairy cows is like you could keep her around for a little bit longer, but the resources to care for her and you know, especially as an animal becomes older, it becomes harder for her to move around and continue to eat what she wants to eat. And there becomes a point at which it is just, again, more human, more sustainable to.
Yeah, and in a perfect world, we'd have a retirement pasture where they could just go live out their days. But that's not the way it is economically or feasibly in any way. We just couldn't.
Right, and I think that's not to end on a bittersweet note, right? But I think it's important for people to understand that this is. Like all of this stuff that I think cheese people especially try, if they don't, I don't want to say try not to engage with, but tend not to engage with.
Right.
These are all sort of essential parts of dairying and of creating like the high quality milk that goes into your favorite cheeses. And without kind of these sorts of plans and finding ways to reduce resource use, increase revenue, and tell the story about these animals. You wouldn't be able to produce as the high quality milk that you wouldn't have the freedom to do what it is that you want to do.
Right. I mean, yeah, and it's very helpful that Peter Henry was able to make the connection for us too, because I've always thought like that this kind of beef would be good in the city, but I have no idea how to connect with someone like you. So it's an important link that he's provided for us, and
yeah, we should
appreciate it.
Absolutely, thank Peter from Consider Bardwell, and been a friend for a long time, and he's helped us out. I think with veal calves in the past, the occasional veal calf, and this was, I think this just made perfect sense to me, and allowed us to have a conversation that we don't normally have. And I think it's good to shake things up every now and then.
Sure. Well,
Dan, I think we've got to finish up, but I very, very much appreciate your time. Thank you for making time for us and for talking about this. And thank you for Alice. We're really excited, and we will do right by her.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. And let me know how it goes.
I will do. Thanks so much. And this has been Cutting the Curd Radio. Again, I'm Aaron Foster, your host. And our guest today was Dan Brooks of Wayward Goose Farm. And we really appreciate having him on. We'll see you next time. Thank you.
The This program is powered by Simplecast.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.